Welcome back to There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast. Join us as we speak to longtime folk musician and songwriter, Tom Paxton. In this conversation, Tom speaks about his early musical influences and the role Pete played in impacting his musical philosophy, as well as Tom's relationship with political music and the purpose of what folk music is. We speak about the 1968 Woody Guthrie tribute concert, Phil Oakes, Broadside Magazine, and what Seeger's legacy is in contemporary times. All right. Well, Tom Paxton, welcome to There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast. I'm so excited to have you here today. Thank you for being available.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Tom, I have this podcast about Pete that has investigated many things. We have spoken to other people, David Dunaway, his biographer. We spoke to Elijah Wald last year, who wrote the book about Dylan and the Newport Festival. And what I like learning from people is from performers like you and others, you know, scholars or researchers or whomever interacted with Pete musically or culturally, what your interpretations of Pete Seeger were. And what I understand about you is that, you know, you're born in Chicago, moved to Arizona when you were young, and then lived in Oklahoma. And when you were an undergraduate, that's when you were exposed to folk music and the Weaver,
yes,
and Pete Seeger. And I'm wondering, at that time, was it the Weavers that drew your attention, and or was it Pete specifically that captured your attention with folk music?
Well, first I've got to get to the Wikipedia and correct them. Biological. I did not live in Arizona. Arizona was crucial for my soul, but it was not a residence. It was in the year 47. My father had the second of two operations at Mayo Clinic to try to correct a circulatory problem that, which nowadays would be an outpatient thing, but then it was it proved to be fatal. And we spent the winter of 47-48 on a dude ranch in Arizona for his convalescence, which didn't do the trick. But it gave me a lifetime love of the desert. And then we went back to Chicago in March of 48. Then later in 48, we moved to Oklahoma, and he died over Labor Day weekend in 48. So it was Chicago to Oklahoma. And I finished growing up in Oklahoma. My love of folk music, I'm planning to say this in an acceptance speech. I'm going into the Hall of Fame of folk music in next month, and I'm going to say that folk music had me from Jimmy Crack Corn. I loved those folk songs from the beginning. I didn't know you called them folk songs, but Jimmy Crack Corn and I Don't Care just tickled my funny bone, as it has for, you know, millions. And I didn't know you called them folk songs. I'd heard them now and then, and we'd have one or two in school programs and stuff. But then I started to hear more Burl Ives, and that I said, that's it. I love those songs. I liked all the pop songs of the day, like My Friends and everything, but they didn't stick to the ribs the way folk songs did. I mean, I still think that the Blue Tail Fly is a great little song. And I've left the pop songs behind. But it was a gradual process of finding more and more folk songs. And I got a guitar and started learning a few chords and learned a few folk songs. And by the time I went to the University of Oklahoma in the fall of 55, I knew that I loved these songs, and I would check records out of the university library and learn songs off of them. There was a wonderful singer from Canada named Ed McCurdy. I learned songs off of his albums and later became friends with Ed. And my interest kept deepening. And then one day, I went over to see a friend of mine who also liked to play folk songs. His name was Johnny Horton, not to be confused with the country singer. And Johnny and I later formed our own little Kingston trio. And he said, listen to this. And he put the needle down on an LP. And out came Pete's banjo playing Darlin' Corey, and it was the Weavers of Carnegie Hall. And I was able later to thank each one of the Weavers for ruining my life. And they all laughed without a trace of pity, unashamed of having corrupted me the way they did. But that album for me was transformative. It was my Road to Damascus experience, because by the time it got to the end of the second side, I had undergone a chromosomal change. I had gone from someone who loved it and become someone who had to do it. My road was very clear. I was a theater student. I have a degree in drama. I love the theater. I loved acting, but as I like to say, I thought it over and decided that I would go for the security of folk music. and off I went. Mm-hmm. By the time I finished college, I knew this is what I wanted to be on this particular bus, and I've never had any other kind of employment since then.
When you arrived in Greenwich Village in 1960, I believe.
Yes.
And you were in the Army Reserve, and you were traveling in from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. From Dix, and you had the time and the geographical ability to start seeing the village. And you've spoken about this was a period where the beat moment was starting to fade and the folk was coming in, and you were able to see it before the whole transformation.
Yeah, it was fading fast, actually. When I got there in the spring, and it was wonderful to be new in the village and seeing it go on and see that go into coffee houses like the Gaslight, and they had a couple of poets, John Brent and Hugh Romney, were reciting their poems, and there was a folk singer named Jimmy Gavin, who was kind of between the poets, just for a change of pace. And it was pretty much like that around the village. The poets were still reading, and the people were coming by the flocking there on weekends to see the beat poets use the F word. That was all very new, and oh my goodness, it was they had to see it and see the village chicks with their heavy eye makeup and black hose, and it was all very exotic, and it was the end of the Eisenhower years, and big changes were coming, and the civil rights movement had begun. There was sit-ins going on in the South, and I met a folk singer at the Gaslight named Len Chandler, and he had me come with him up to the Woolworth store on Broadway, that we were doing a picket line in front of the Woolworth because of the Woolworth in the South was being sat in by the civil rights movement. And so this was a support strike. And that was my introduction to political songs and social justice songs. And my first protest song was written at that point. It was called Mr. Woolworth, I think. And it was a pretty pathetic song, actually. It was my first toe in the water.
Is there a record of that song?
No.
I'm curious.
Let me see. And we'll sit down. We'll sit down. It was Faubus, Bilbo, Boba, Casper, and it's you're now that we're after. Till we get our freedom, we'll sit down. Something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't awful, but it was kind of awful.
When you were there in those early 60s Village days, to what extent was Pete Seeger a presence in the clubs and in the venues? Was he there when you guys were performing? Would you go out to see him when he had his own shows? Because he played at the Vanguard many times or at the Bitter End. But to what extent was he present in the scene that you were performing in?
Well, I think I saw while I was still in the Army on a weekend, I saw him at Carnegie Hall in a hootenanny. There were several different people on the bill. I think it was a benefit for Sing Out or something like that. And I was up in the balcony and I thought it was just wonderful. My goodness, it was good. I don't remember who any of the other artists were on that. It was mainly Pete I went to see. And then I saw him at the Village Gate, which was by far the largest venue in the Deep Village. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have a lot of folk music there, although the only time I played there, I was third on the bill to Miriam Makeba. I forget who the second on the bill was. And Mary McCabe would have vocal problems because I don't know why. And one night, an up-and-coming comedian named Woody Allen subbed for her, and I thought he was incredible, so funny. But it was at the Village Gate one Sunday afternoon. Once a month, Art DeLugoff, the owner, opened the gate for us on a Sunday afternoon to raise money for Broadside magazine, the topical song magazine that was running. And this is off subject, but we did it hootenanny style, which is to say everybody sat on stage together. And when it was your turn, you got up and went to the microphone, did your song, and sat back down. And that kind of move things along instead of a lot of introductions and stuff. And sitting between Len Chandler and I was a little kid from New Jersey named Janice. That was Janice Ian's first time to sing. I think it was her first time to sing in public. And her guitar was about as big as she was. And she got up and sang some song that was so full of sass that Len and I were just pounding on each other with delight. She was great. And it was after, no, it wasn't after one of those hootenays. It was after a meeting that we had there in 62, I guess it was, that was called to about boycotting the Hootenanny TV show, which was on ABC and was emphasizing the clean and scrubbed folk music, in quotes, They wasn't, I mean, they weren't terrible. It wasn't bad. They had great groups on there like Chad Mitchell Trio. And let me see who else. And Judy Collins was on it. But a bunch of us were boycotting it. Not that they were pounding on us to come on, because they were blackballing Pete. The talent producer for that thing was Fred Weintraub, who owned the Bitter End, and he had the unmitigated gall to say that they weren't blackballing Pete at all. They just didn't have him on the show because they were not sure of his ability to hold an audience. This is a man who had everybody in Carnegie Hall singing three-part harmony, and so we organized a boycott, and we got a lot of people to say they would not go on. So it was not a good show, I think. But I know I was part of that boycott, and Pete came down to speak to us, and of course, being Pete, he tried to talk us out of doing the boycott. He said it was good, and it was getting folk music in front of a much larger audience. And we said, "Thanks a lot, Pete, but we're still going to do it." But it was after that meeting that I got up my nerve, and I went up to Pete and said, asked him if I could sing him a song that I'd just written, which was "Ramblin' Boy." And happily, he loved the song. And sang it a couple weeks later at Carnegie Hall for the reunion album with the Weavers. Now, I didn't know whether to shit or go blind. I was so happy. But he did more than that. He came down. He came down to the village where I was staying with a tape recorder and taped a bunch of my songs, which led to him singing "What'd You Learn in School Today," which he later claimed was one of his 10 favorite songs. He told me about being in India in some little village, and a guy came up and sang some of it to him.
Wow.
Oh my God. Yes.
Someone even in India knew your songs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Knew he knew he'd heard the I guess he heard the album that Pete did, the We Shall Overcome album from Carnegie Hall, and learned the song and sang it to Pete.
That's amazing.
And
That I have never heard. That's incredible. Wow.
yeah, great, great story.
Wow.
And
Well,
Go ahead, sorry.
perfect example of, I mean, when you let a song go, you never know where it's going. I was in Australia once at Adelaide at a folk club. It was in a kind of a large room, where there were no dressing room or anything like that. We just sat over in the corner of the big table, and during the break, two very pretty college girls came over to the table and kind of shyly asked me if they could sing something for me, and I said sure. And they sang a verse and chorus of "The Last Thing on My Mind" in Croatian. And I thought, my God, you do get around, don't you?
Well.
But that was when I began to get to know Pete. You ask if his presence was keenly felt in the village, and well, it was part of the DNA of the village. We were all at least in awe of Pete. He was certainly, without asking it of us, he was the leader. We were always kind of measuring, what would Pete think? Would Pete like this song? And we'd see him from time to time, and he would come in the gaslight. He wasn't around much, but he wasn't far away either.
Interesting. And the symbolic significance Pete had for you, was that because of his musicianship? Was that because of his former association with Woody and the Almanacs? And was he a legend in those respects? Like, what gave him that symbolic quality to all of you?
Well, I think it was the sum of all of that, and the fact that he knew every song there was, you know, and he had just a voluminous repertoire. He'd been everywhere, sung for everybody, and he was just larger than life in that respect. But of course, he was still just Pete, the most unassuming man you ever met in your life. Nothing was ever about Pete with Pete.
Meaning he never made it about him. It was always about the
ever. It was all about the music and the work and the goals. I know I had a conversation with him at one few years further down the road, which he was telling me about leaving the party. And about how they had come to feel they just faced the fact that they'd been bamboozled, and that they had come to see that, if anything, Stalin was worse than Hitler. He certainly killed more of his own people than Hitler. Hitler didn't kill that many Germans by comparison, and Stalin didn't show any kind of restraint in that matter at all. So I wanted to ask him a little bit. I was kind of fascinated about all the CP stuff. I mean, I was never personally remotely interested in the Communist Party. I was always a Democrat then and now. But I could appreciate the context of the 30s and 40s and 50s. One of the few answers was communism. It was the wrong answer, but I could understand why people would reach that conclusion in the context of their times and with the things the way they were. So I asked him about that, and he was very frank about it. And he said he planned to live the rest of his life as a small C communist. That's the way he put it. He still believed in the idealism. He had come to see that as a working government, it didn't work at all.
Do you remember, Tom, about when you had that conversation with Pete? Like, what time?
Yeah, I think it was after we moved down here to Virginia, so that would put it pretty late, say around 90.
Because, yeah, he did not speak publicly about any of that until the 1970s. When he started doing interviews for his biography and things like that.
To stray, we thought we'd try to work one day. The boss said he had room for one. Says my old pal, we'd rather bum. And here's to you, my rambling boy. May all your ramblings bring you joy.
But, I mean, the political side of Pete, you said the sum of its parts. I mean, when he was blacklisted in the mid-late 50s, and then you have the television blacklist that you were talking about with Hootenanny, that you were organizing around. What was it? Was there, were you following that when Pete was blacklisted in 1955 with the committee? Was that something that you were conscious of? And
no, no, my life in Oklahoma was totally apolitical. I was a drama student in college, and I was kind of 24/7 thinking theater. And I mean, I hadn't even dared to dream about performing a performing career. I had no idea about that. I mean, I knew I loved to do it, and but thinking of that as a profession had never occurred to me.
I'm curious also, and you may not know the answer to this question, and if you don't want to answer it also, that's fine, but the Woody Guthrie Memorial Concert in January of 68, you were
right
there. And I first was. Of all, Tom, I love your version of Pastures of Plenty. That's the one I listened to when I worked up my banjo rendition of the song. I think is so excellent. And in that show, you got a lot of performers that I learned later on was written by Mill Lampell in the 50s, the script taken from Bound for Glory, and was originally called From California to the New York Island. And Woody had seen that show when he was in a wheelchair. They brought him out of the hospital to see it in the 50s at some point, but it was reproduced after he died. And one of the elephants in the room with that concert, though, as great as the music I think is the fact that Phil Oakes was not part of that concert.
I've never forgotten that. It's kind of an unforgivable omission. If anyone there should have been in that concert, it was Phil. And in this movie about Dylan, which was not a bad movie, it was unforgivable that Phil was not even mentioned. Certainly, Phil's relationship with Dylan was much more dynamic than mine was. Mine was a friendly, I had many nice moments with Bob, although I can say with honesty, I never got to know him. Who did? But I liked him, is what I'm saying. But he and Phil would go at it. I think that Phil helped to make Bob Dylan Bob Dylan. Challenged him a lot, argued a lot. You're right about that concert. I'll be honest, I didn't think that much about it then, but the more I think about it, the angrier I get that he wasn't in it. He belonged.
I mean, he did had a conversation with Sis Cunningham and Gordon Friesen in early 68 or mid 68. And there's a recording of this they did for Broadside, this interview they did with Phil, where Phil talks about that he wasn't part of the program and he was in the audience. He was there for the show. But he, during the last number of the concert, he got up and left. He walked out. And he was perplexed as to why he wasn't invited, given the songs he had written and the kind of, you know, artist he was. According to Phil, Marjorie Guthrie told him that it had been planned before Woody died, and Phil always felt like there was some sort of conspiracy that he wasn't involved. And I don't know enough details still about who was responsible, whether it was Grossman or whether it was someone else for making these performer decisions. I don't know if Pete knew about it either, or if anything was done to try and get Phil a part of it. I mean, I don't know if you know anything about the inside of this.
No. No, I don't. My favorite recollection about that concert, which I really think is one of the two or three highlights of my career, was being in that concert. As you know, it was done in Hootenanny style. Stairs, we all sat on the stage together. When we lined up on the stage, behind the curtain, we were technically in the hall, so we could feel the vibrations of that place. And that place was, I mean, every lefty east of the Mississippi was there, I think. And I mean, this was farewell to Woody, for God's sake. So it was sky high, sky high. And as it happened, I sat next to Bob on the stage. So we were standing together behind the curtain. And as you'll recall, this was the first time Bob appeared in public in at least a year because of his accident. Mm-hmm. So we're all standing back there waiting to go on and with the kind of anticipation and the nerves and stuff. And I turned to Bob and I said, Bob, I have to, you know, give you a little heads up here. I mean, when we come out on the stage, they're going to see me and they're going to go nuts. You know, so just be ready for that. All right. And he got a good laugh. He got a good laugh. It was fun. But my God, it was such an experience I'll never forget.
What I think is incredibly unique is that, I mean, you're right. Yeah, Bob hadn't been seen publicly in several years. But then, you know, he brings the band down with him from Woodstock to play behind him. And yeah. the choice of song, the arrangement, it's a unique thing to have Pete Seeger's on the same stage as Robbie Robertson, right?
Yeah.
That to me is a remarkable coalescence. And Dylan is this link that in a way enables that to happen, in a sense. At the same time, you know, Ronald Cohen quotes Sis and Gordon saying that Woody might have walked out on the concert. That, you know, it was in a way paying homage to him and saying goodbye to him, like you were saying. But some people, I guess, felt like this isn't real. You know, this isn't the right recognition of Woody for some reason.
Why would they say that? I don't know. Because the band played electric guitars?
I don't know if it was that simple. I might have had to do with Phil. They didn't feel like it was an understanding of Woody. That's my interpretation of what they said. So I love the music. I think it's a great concert. I listen to it all the time. But I guess there are varying shades of opinion about interpretation with this thing.
Well, all I can say is that the folk music community has never been slow to hold a grudge, and express anger at somebody else sitting next to them. And I can't imagine why anyone would. That was a great concert.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about if you remember, there's the folk festival in Cambridge, Massachusetts in March of 66, which was like called the Boston Winter Fest, or also called the Boston Folk Festival. And I think you were there and Phil might have been there performing. But this was notable because, according to Ronald Cohen, Barry Sadler was there singing the Ballad of the Green Beret.
Yeah, I was there.
What was that all about?
Well, it was a mystery to us why he was included in that concert. And you know, I've taken myself to task. Shame on me for not going up to Barry Sadler and introducing myself and welcoming him. God damn it! You know, we didn't say word boo to him, and I think that was really rude of us. I mean, I never thought much of his song, but I think it did a lot for people who supported the war, and he was a Green Beret. He did his bit, and I think we were rude to him and unnecessarily. It wouldn't have killed us to come up and shake hands and say how you doing. Shame on us.
I want to ask you about, you've spoken before and you said that, you know, you were never a radical. and you never initially saw yourself as a political person. That was not part of your socialization. At the same time, you've written many political songs,
I have.
which I've always found are very poignant. And, for example, you played on Pete's television show, Rainbow Quest, and you play that song, Buy a Gun for Your Son.
Not a bad
And
song.
you were on Pete's show, that very first episode, I think, of Rainbow Quest, which also had the Clancy brothers.
Yes.
But you're only on for maybe a 15 minute segment. Was that only the amount of time Pete gave you, or was there more, or was that
No,
it?
that was all I got. I was in like an opening act. I mean, it was mainly the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem were the main guests, and so I got fairly treated, I thought, But I've always thought the reason, one of the reasons I love folk music as we have known it in the last 60 years or 70 years or whatever it is, one of the things I love about it is that it doesn't have to pass any kind of a commercial test. No one ever asks, is this song going to make any money? The way they have to do in pop or country. Is this song going to make any money? If it's not, they've got this machine that has to be fed, and so they have to make money. And that's, to me, I love, and I'm not alone in this, I love the idea that when I get an idea for a song, if I like the idea, I write the song. I don't have to worry about whether, I mean, I know in advance it's not going to make any money. But write it anyhow.
And was it Pete that set a standard for that in terms of the writing of a political song and that kind of standard or that principle? Did that come from him, or is
I
that just
don't
what you
know.
learned?
I think it just kind of inherited in what we all felt, and that right now I'm writing every Wednesday at 10 o'clock. I am on Zoom with my friend Kathy Fink, and we're writing topical songs, what I call short shelf life songs. And most of the time, Kathy goes back to her house in Silver Spring and does a quick video and puts it up. So, and you go on YouTube and you'll see we must have put 20 or 30 songs on there by now. And they're all topical songs. They're all not only not going to make any money, they'll probably cost us money. But that's what we're here for.
And you wrote something interesting in Sing Out in 1996, where you were talking about the topical songs or the freedom songs as they were written in regard to the civil rights movement. And one thing I found interesting about what you said is, and I guess I'm quoting you now, you said they had choruses that could raise the courage of those who sang them.
Yes.
Courage that was far from rhetorical when sung in the face of Bull Connors, the Cecil Prices, and the Klansmen.
That's right.
But when you say far from rhetorical, what does that mean exactly?
I mean, it meant it was an action song. You sang this song in the face of people who violently disagreed with you. It could be dangerous to sing these songs on the street. I never felt endangered when I sang these songs. A couple of marches that I was on, there was some really vicious stuff yelled from the sidewalk, but I never felt personally that anyone was going to run out and take a punch at me. But these were not songs that were going to make you popular. They're slogans. They're meant to inspire action. They're meant to even change minds or to be heard as support. I mean, it's an old tradition. In the Burl Ives songbook, I have my first songbook upstairs in the house here. It's a red cover paperback Burl Ives songbook that I bought in the 50s. I'm afraid to open it. It's all just gonna come out, you know, in pieces. It's probably just turned to dust by now. But there are songs in there that were sung in colonial America that would have to get you tossed in jail in Boston in before the Revolutionary War. I mean, these were very angry songs. What a court hath old England, one of those songs called. I never figured out the tune to it or anything, but I remember the title. Mm-hmm. What a court hath old England. This was not a happy colonist song. It's a tradition that goes as far back as songs go.
Did you ever have any sense of what Pete thought about Phil Oakes's music?
Oh, I think he liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Pete thought very highly of Phil. We all did. We all thought highly of Phil. When you listen to his stuff now, one of the things that strikes you is how well he sang and how well he played. And what a softy he was as well. He could be, you know, a sweet song as well. Mm-hmm. Nobody buys flowers from the flower lady.
What is your favorite song that Phil wrote?
There But For Fortune. It's the only song by anyone else that I've recorded. Mm-hmm. I put it on a concert album I did from an English tour. I was singing it in the Kate Wolf Festival once, and all of a sudden there was a harmony coming in. Joan Baez came out and sang the rest of it with me. She sang it beautifully too. What didn't she sing beautifully?
And both you and Phil were, of course, deeply involved in the Broadside Project in the very beginning. And
sure.
Can you describe for us, like, I mean, you talked earlier a little bit about what some of those Broadside hootenannies were like, but my understanding is Pete would bring a recording device, a tape recorder, and that's how, you know, he would play a role in getting the songs down so that Sis could transcribe them and they could be printed, sure, distributed. I mean, how significant was Pete for Broadside in distributing?
Oh, songs? He was our uncle. I mean, he was the adult in the room. He couldn't have been more supportive. When we did the Folkways recording album, he was in the studio with us. It couldn't have been more supportive than he was.
I was wondering, maybe, I mean, I asked you about Phil, but is what's a song of Pete's that you connected with significantly?
Oh, so many. Of course, the obvious ones like Turn, 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 Sailing on My, what's the title?
Golden River, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Let me think. Well, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Learned that from Len Chandler. I think Len Chandler was the first one who sang that. Those are certainly, had I a golden dress and needle so fine.
Yeah.
Just beautiful songs. You know what? That period and Pete, there was a photograph book back in the 50s. Of course, now with Amazon, you can probably still get it. It was called The Family of Man. And it was all black and white photographs of people living life. And they must have started with 100,000 photographs and just picked the ones they picked. And that's what I think of it as folk music, is that book being sung. And that's what Pete has been to me. Here's how you live life. Here's a way to get your ideas straight. Here's a way to set your principles. And there's a song for every one of them.
I mean, being in a Pete Seeger concert, I never got the chance to see him. My grandfather knew him in the late 1940s, before the Weavers. But I never got to see Pete perform. My father did. But the experience of being in the hall when Pete was performing, and his uncanny ability to get people involved and as participants in the concert, he just had an ability to be able to do that. And that was a unique experience. Whereas, you know, Phil's concerts are, he's making a direct statement and he wants you to hear what he has to say. With Pete, it's like, you know, you're a member. It's a slightly different experience, right? I mean, what was the experience like?
Yes, I think my concerts were a little kind of a combination of that. But Phil's concerts were confrontational, I guess you might say. But then so were Dylan's. But I think I was more in Pete's line of work. Maybe try to persuade a little. I don't know. I'm too close to myself to be able to judge. But Phil's concerts were, here's how it is. Take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. Like me or not, here's how I friggin' well see it.
That leads me to also asking you, when you think about folk music 60 years ago, and you think about the role of folk music today, we live in a different world. We live in a world where we don't have as many leaders, it seems to me, that we used to have, or figures. And Pete was a figure, and he meant something. And we don't really have like a folk song protest movement in the way that it once existed. And so, you know, what role does folk music, protest music, political music, whatever it is, what role does it have today? And can that be mustered ever again and have any sort of impact?
Well, you might be getting it wrong. It might not be that the folk music is different. It's that people aren't paying the same kind of attention, although they're starting to. I think I'm seeing it more and more in the press that the population, including people who don't get involved in politics very much, are getting very, very angry with the current administration, shall we put it that way. And I think that might be it. I mean, the folk music keeps going on. There's a couple of kids out now on YouTube, and I'm embarrassed that I don't have their names. Two young men are writing Dylan kind of songs and making a splash, and that's great. And I hope they'll forgive me for not remembering their names. I will shortly. So, as Van Ronk put it once, you know, when someone was saying, why aren't people protesting now the way they were in the 60s? And he says, there's no draft. There's no draft. You know, when you could get plucked out of your life, handed a rifle and find yourself in Da Nang, that would count as The old English philosopher, what was his name? Come on. Samuel Johnson would say the prospect of being hanging concentrates the mind wonderfully. And the same thing would be true of being sent to Vietnam. That's not happening. So if one wants to, one can just pull one's head in and go through life without that danger always looming over your shoulder. So you put the draft back in and see how little people pay attention.
I got a letter from LBJ. It said, "This is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very queer, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam." Lyndon Johnson told the nation, "Have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese." I jumped off the old troop ship and sank in mud up.
Well, then, Tom, this might be my last question, but what is Pete Seeger's legacy today? How do we look at Pete Seeger? How should we look at Pete Seeger now?
I think Pete is saying, organize, complain, write, sing, march. Don't stay at home unless you're writing a good song.
Well, Tom Paxton, thank you for being part of There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast. Thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
And what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Folks, thanks for joining us for this interesting conversation with Tom Paxton. First of all, I'd like to thank Tom again for being available and being interested in being on the podcast with us. Great opportunity to speak with him. Tom is much older now, and I'm just so happy he was able to join us. I think he made a lot of interesting insights and a lot of insider information given Tom's career, where he was at the time, and all the people that he knew, and all the great songs that he wrote. Anyway, I think that our conversation speaks for itself, and I think he's a good person to talk to about characterizing Pete in terms of like the musical and cultural leadership, if we will, that was present when everything was new. Anyway, I'll keep it brief here today. Hopefully soon we'll return to the content episodes, and I look forward to producing those and getting back to you all. This is just such a great, I was so excited to have this conversation with Tom that I wanted to get it out as soon as possible. I did it very recently, February of 2026. So hope you enjoyed it. Anyway, see you all next month.
There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast, is written, recorded, and produced by Adam C. Morse. See y'all next time.